Six music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time, where we look at the pivotal first moments that made some of our most influential musicians who they are today. This week, our guest is one of the most highly regarded figures in British music, a man who figured in not just one, but two of the most significant bands of all time, as well as looming large in the lineup of a handful of other excellent groups, including his current project, Bad Lieutenant. Welcome, Bernard Sumner.
Hi, Matt. All right?
I'm good.
Good to be here.
We start off with the most obvious question: when was the first time you were aware of music as a kid?
Well, it's funny because we didn't have a record player in the house, and we had a little radio that, you know, one of these little 60s radios. I grew up with my grandparents. They just had this little radio. I remember it playing the Beatles coming out of it. just pre-Motown it was, and the Beatles being on TV and hearing the Beatles being played. So I guess it was the Beatles, really. That's my first recollection. And I liked it because it had guitars in it as well.
If you remember kind of making an impression on you?
The first one was, I guess, Ride a White Swan by T-Rex, which did end up being the first single I ever bought. I like Big Yellow Taxi by Joni Mitchell as well. That was a cute little track. Anything with a good tune in it, and preferably with a bit of a guitar in it, because I like the sound of guitar. Ride your luck like a bird in the sky was ride it all out like you were a bird. Ride it all out like an eagle in a sunbeam. Ride it all out like you were a bird. Wear a tall hat like a druid in the old days. Wear a tall hat and a tattooed gown. Ride a white swan like the people of a bell chain. Wear your hair long, babe, you can't go wrong. A bright star and a place you know your forehead. Say a few spells and baby there you go. Take a black cat and a sip it on your shoulder, and in the morning you'll know all you know.
They paid paradise, put up a parking lot, a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum, and they charged the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
When did you get your first guitar?
I was 16.
That's quite late.
I was a bit of a late developer. I won't tell you what I was into before guitars, but...
Girls, I presume?
I would have liked to have been, yeah, but... I was into scooters with a little scooter boy. So I was into Scooters and Crombie and the two-tone trousers and all that business. It was about 1972, I think, something like that. But that was an interesting musical education. And there were two sources for my musical education. Three, if you had radio. I used to go on my scooter. I used to go to this youth club in Salford, where I come from, called North Salford Youth Club. And downstairs at that youth club, they had a disco, and the disco used to play Tamla Motown and Stax Records. And then upstairs, they used to have more serious music, like Led Zeppelin and the Stones and Free and all that kind of rock from that period, you know, and a host of other American groups. So it was a good place to go and get an education, because you got kind of the dance vibes of Tamla down below, and then you got the kind of guitar music that I liked upstairs. That was a good place to learn about music, yeah.
What was the first gig you went to, the first proper gig?
Oh, my God.
Of someone...
I remember hearing on the old Grey Whistle Test, seeing Santana and thinking, I quite like that, you know, a lot of guitar, anything with guitars in it. And I saw Santana and I went to see him play live at in Manchester, somewhere in Manchester. I think it was Stretford. Height of their popularity, you know. And I think they'd just done Woodstock and stuff. And there was masses of people there. And it was Manchester and everyone was vibed up, you know. And then Carlos Santana came on and they turned the lights down and the spotlight went on him. And he said, before I start the set, and he put his hands together, and he went, please meditate with me for 2 minutes. Of course, this didn't go down very well in Manchester. It might have done in LA, but it wasn't the correct thing to do in Manchester. So the results were quite hilarious, really. Just people chucking stuff, you know. Get on with it. I was about 21 when the punk thing started happening, and you know, at that age there were two choices of places to go out and socialise in Manchester. One was the discos, you know, that play like Roxy Music and David Bowie and soul music, you know, and the other place was gigs. So you know, at that age you want to go out all the time, don't you? So I remember before the Pistols, going to see Buzzcocks. We'd read in The Enemy and stuff about this new happening music, punk, and we liked the photographs of Johnny Rotten, the clothes that we were wearing. There was a local group that was rumoured to be into that type of music, which was the Buzzcocks, so we used to go and see the Buzzcocks and actually befriended them, and they gave us a few tips when we decided to start a group up, which I'm obviously eternally grateful for Peter Shelley for doing that. And then the next thing was the Buzzcocks were going to support the Pistols at the Free Trade Hall, so we you know, we'd read all about the Pistols and heard some music on the radio, so we went down to it, and it was, I mean, it's a legendary gig that. As with all legends, when you look at the cold, clean truth, it wasn't that fantastic a gig. I actually recorded it on my little cassette recorder, bootlegged it, but I mean, it sounded really bad. But the vibe was fantastic. And, you know, the local legend is that out of the hundreds or so people that were at that gig, 25 groups were formed, you know, from just the people that were at that gig. So it was, I'm going to say something very posh now, it was a moment of catharsis. The thing about it was, and about the whole punk movement, you see, I had those two phases of my early musical development. I had the Santana and the, you know, the kind of, not prog rock, but all those rock bands, and they were like, you know, the emphasis on that kind of music was virtuosity, you know, and we were like, in fact, when I got my guitar when I was 16 years old, I just put it in the corner of the room because I thought, I'll never be able to play like that. I left it, I literally left it in the corner of the room, and then went to see the Sex Pistols. I thought, you don't have to be able to play like that to form a group. And this group looks like it's a lot more fun to be in this group than it did with the other groups. So then at that moment, I picked the guitar up, literally did pick it up, like 16, 17, 18, 19, 10. 5 years later, I picked the guitar up, bought a book, How to Play the Guitar. You know, the next thing was, with a few other musicians, we formed Joy Division, you know.
What were your first impressions of Ian Curtis?
We'd actually met Ian at some punk gigs, so we kind of knew him very loosely. And he actually hung around with another guy who, confusingly, was called Ian. And we called him the Two Ians, right? So we knew him vaguely just from... Because those punk gigs were really friendly, really... Just a great vibe, you know. They don't look it when you see old film of it. But the punk gigs were really friendly. And no, the great thing about them was no one took themselves too seriously. And that was the whole message of punk for me, was don't take yourself too seriously, you know. Don't get too big for your boots. Don't take yourself too seriously. Just have a laugh and enjoy life, you know. So it was very important to me on that level. So I'd met Ian, the Two Ians, at a few gigs. And then me and Peter Hooker got together, and he bought a book on how to play bass, and I bought a book on how to play guitar, and we sat in my grandmother's front room, sort of practicing every Sunday, and then we were like, right, we're good enough now to be able to write some songs, after about 2 weeks, you know. So we decided to advertise for a singer, and we advertised for a singer in the Virgin Records in Manchester Piccadilly, and... Stupidly, I put my phone number on the thing, my mother's phone number, because I still live with my mum then, you know. I started getting all these lunatics phoning my mum's phone at all different times of the day. And, you know, and then I remember going out to see one guy, this hippie who lived in Didsbury, and he was a proper hippie, and he had, like, cushion covers that he'd cut holes in the cushion covers and made... a pullover out of it, and he was sat cross-legged auditioning to me with a balalaika, reading his poetry out to me and one of our roadies, you know, we had a roadie even at that point. Me and the roadie were like biting our tongues off, just trying not to laugh, you know, and he's playing this balalaika and just sort of went, it's not punk, mate, you know, it's not punk. It's not quite what we're after. So I had quite a few loonies like this ring me up wanting to be the singer. And then Ian called one night. I even remember where I took the call. It was in my mother's bedroom on the left-hand side of the bed near the window. He said, oh, it's Ian. I think you might know me. I said, which Ian? He said, oh, you know the two Ians? So I was like, oh, right. And I was so relieved, like, that it wasn't another knobhead, you know, that I said to him, I said, right, so it's you, ain't it? Yeah, yeah. Right, you got the job. Just gave him the job. I said, you know, you got anything to sing through? He said, yeah, I've got a PA system. I said, all right, you know, where are you living? Oh, we're living with my mum, you know, him and his wife are living with his mum. They had nowhere to live. And he said, all right, come down on Sunday, let's rehearse. And that's how it started.
People's reactions when they first heard Love Will Tear Us Apart?
Love Will Tear Us Apart, I can't remember anything about writing it, but I don't know, we just used to jam it in the rehearsal room and we just jammed it out and it became one of the other songs. And then we were going in, I think we were doing a session at Britannia Row, which was, if it was Britannia Row, which was down here in London, it used to be Pink Floyd's old studio and we used to get a great sound there. We'd recorded a version of Love Will Tear Us Apart down at Strawberry in Stockport, and we just didn't like it. You know, it was part was the studio, but part was Martin. Martin Hannett was either brilliant or crap.
It's your producer?
Yeah, which actually could be said of us as well, you know. Our live gigs were well into the days of New Order, were either brilliant or crap. Just the way things worked in those days, you know. So Martin was either brilliant or crap, and we could hear the potential of this song and knew that it's there was something about it, you know. And we got the mix off Martin and just didn't really like it. We didn't feel the drums were powerful enough and it just didn't sound powerful enough. So we made him do it again. So I think we were doing some sessions for Closer, down at Britannia Row, a second Joy Division album, and we said, right, Martin, Love Will Tear Us Apart, what? Don't feel it sounds that great. It sounds great, what are you on about? No, we've got to do it again, Martin, we've got to do it again. We've been playing it live, it goes down really well and we want to capture the live essence of it. So he was bugged that we didn't like his original version, so we record it again. We just spent a day recording it, and we did all the drums, we did Ian's vocal, and it was overdub time. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. Steve Morris, the drummer, had gone home, you know, he likes an early night, Steve. And I was still working on some 12-string guitar melodies on 2 o'clock in the morning, and then I finished them about 2 o'clock, and Martin turned around to Rob and went, right, Rob, get Steve back. Is that what? He's right over the other side of London. We had a flat somewhere near Harrods somewhere, and we were in Islington. And he went, no, get Steve. I need Steve now to finish this track. And he was just being arse, you know. So Rob phones Steve. Steve drives all the way across London, arrives at the studio, and Martin goes, right, back in. He said, I want you to double track the snare drum. And you never double track a snare drum. You never double track a snare drum because it phases and flanges and makes all sorts of weird noises. And Steve was just so annoyed. And he just whacked the hell out of that bloody snare drum. Now, whether Martin got Steve in at that time to get some attitude out of him on the snare drum, or whether Martin just did it, it's hard to tell, you know, and unfortunately Martin's not here to defend himself, so I don't think it was the former of those two reasons rather than the latter, you know. But anyway, we recorded it. We liked the second recording. And then Ian died and the track came out. But I remember it was like it was going to be on it was going to be on Top of the Pops or something, the video. We're going to show it. But because all BBC were on, the guys from the studio were on strike that week. So it didn't get shown. So it only got to like number 13, aptly, very aptly number 13.
You mentioned it. What were you first doing when you found out that Ian had committed suicide in 1980?
Well, there was a band on Factory called Section 25. They were actually still going, and I was hanging out with them. It was a weekend, and they invited me over, so I went over, and it's really complicated because Ian had split up with his wife then and had been staying with me for 2 weeks. But I used to sit up. I was pretty much an insomniac. I used to sit up all hours of the night, and I think Ian got a bit sick of that, going to bed at 5 in the morning. He was in a pretty, not a great mental state, you know. He was handling it, but he was pretty upset because he just split up with his wife, you know, and things were coming on top for him, as we say in Manchester. He went to stay with his mum and dad, and I was like, well, I've got to see Section 25, I'm going to go. After the weekend, we were supposed to be on a tour of the States, and the phone rings, and it's Rob, my manager, and he just says, I've got some bad news. I said, really bad news. I said, what? And he said, Ian's committed suicide. And Ian had already tried to commit suicide perhaps 3 weeks or something before. I said, what, he's tried again? He said, no, he has. And, you know,
okay.
It's difficult to talk about it, you know, that's all I can say. Really. It's just, I've not spoken about it for a long time, and it's pretty difficult. So it was just an enormous shock, and I remember the room spinning round, you know, and just like you've been hit with a sledgehammer. Also, you know, from a selfish point of view, just all the work we've done has just been thrown away, you know, but you just didn't think he was actually going to do it. You know, you think it's a cry for help and all that. And he took a pill overdose a few weeks earlier. And I just thought, well, he's tried it again. And then the details came out, you know, and that he was dead. And so that was it. The whole world just fell apart, you know.
I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time.
Six Music.
BBC Six Music.
I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time with Bernard Sumner. Following Ian Curtis's death and a tentative debut album from New Order, Movement, in 1981, the band headed to New York. I asked Bernard how significant that first stateside trip was.
We were supposed to be going to New York to do a tour by a promoter called Ruth Polanski. Ruth Polanski, who was great. She was putting the Joy Division tour on. So as soon as New Order became available, she said, "Well, why don't you guys come over to the States?" And I guess she was trying to help us, really, and did help us. Because we wanted to showcase it somewhere where we weren't known, and we weren't known in America. So for us to get up, we all tried singing, me, Peter and Stephen, all tried singing. But we wanted to do it somewhere where perhaps we weren't so well known, you know. So we went over to New York. We did a bit of recording. We recorded Ceremony and in a Lonely Place in Orange, New Jersey. And then we used to travel back to Manhattan, where our hotel was, every night, and we'd go out. Ruth, who was the promoter, was kind of queen of the clubs, you know, and she'd take us around all the nightclubs in New York. And we just got turned on to the New York sort of dance scene, and it was kind of alternate kind of dance scene, you know. And the clubs in New York were very influential, and that's kind of where I got an idea for a new direction. I was just in a club one night in New York, and I heard this great dance music. It wasn't like they were playing back here, like crappy disco, you know, not all disco is crap, but, you know, commercial disco. And they were playing like really good tracks, like crossover tracks, like Sugar Hill. Anyway, a load of good stuff. And I'm just hearing this music, thinking, bloody hell. Right, I'll take that as a challenge. I'm going to make a track that you can play in the club and people will get off on. And I'd got interested in technology, so I actually made a synthesizer from electronic components in Joy Division. And I had quite a few synthesizers. I thought, right, if I can find a way of linking these synths together with some sort of syncing it up to a beat, I could make the music I was hearing in those clubs was all still being played on real instruments, you know, like real bass guitar, real drums and stuff, but they were trying to play it tight and rhythmical. I thought, well, I could do that with, like, I've got some sort of a computer, and I could link all the synthesizers together, make it super tight, which is the sound that these guys are going after, but do it all with synthetic instruments. So yeah, again, another moment of catharsis, another Road to Damascus. I think it was either Haraz or Danceteria, one of them anyway. They were great clubs anyway, you know, that played great music, and it opened my eyes. So and that for me became, right, this is what we should do, this should be the new direction. Now, with the band, that was a bit difficult, you know, because if they were a bloody drum machine in this group, and not in place of my bass with a synthesizer, you know, so I had to battle a bit within the group to get them to do it, you know. And I wasn't very popular for a while doing that, until we had a massive hit, and then opinions changed.
When was the first time you heard Blue Monday in a club, having finished it and been like, this is good? When was the first time you heard it in that environment that it was
again, you know, from working with other musicians? I used to play occasionally and do a bit of production. There was a group on Factory called 52nd Street, and they were like a funk group, and occasionally I'll go out and just play a bit of synthesizing just for the hell of it, and they turn me on to new music. I used to go to like a funk club in Manchester, and it was called Legends, and just these amazing lasers, but they had a great sound system. And I remember going to the club, and I should have been enjoying myself, ogling at girls or whatever, but I was actually checking out the sound system, because I'd never heard such a great sound system in a club, and listened to all the sub-frequencies and the sub-bass and how these funk records were operating on, you know, sonically. So that was part of the learning curve. And then when we recorded Blue Monday, it just came about by having a new synthesizer, which was a Moog, but not a very well-known Moog. I won't go into it because it's a bit of a trade secret. an unusual Moog synthesizer, and a drum machine, a DMX drum machine, and the synthesizer that I'd built myself in Joy Division, and linking them all together. I had a mate in New York who used to, he was a DJ, and he used to send me over cassettes in those days of New York dance stations. And I picked like a few favourite tracks off that these dance stations were playing, and I took elements of each. I didn't copy it exactly. I just went, well, I like that track. I'll do something like that for the beat. I like that track. I'll use an arrangement like they've got. Right, I'll bring some strings in where they bring some strings in, you know. And, oh, like, you know, that, I could do a bass line like this old record, I remember. So it was really a bit like a DJ puts together. In the 90s, was putting together a few of his records and coming up. Say a DJ mixing three of his records together and coming up with a fourth record. Well, I was sort of doing that, but instead of doing it on vinyl, I was doing it on synthesizers, and that's how Blue Monday came apart.
What were the songs? Do you remember?
Dirty Talk, Klein and MBO was one. Our Love Will Last Forever, Lana Summer. You Make Me Feel Mighty Real, Sylvester for the bass line. Like I say, though, I didn't copy the bass line. I just thought, I want a bass line, that has that rhythmic effect, you know. So I just took influences from him. There's probably a couple of others, maybe, in there as well, you know. Certainly, Kraftwerk, Radioactivity, the voices at the start of that got the idea from the Kraftwerk track. So, yeah, it was kind of hacking a lot of different influences and putting them together, you know. Yeah, I don't know where that came from, really. I don't know. And again, it was just the right record at the right time, you know.
Why didn't you order Split Up for the first time in 1993?
Oof. It's a difficult one, that, because when we did get back together after that split up,
we kind of got... We kind of got, wasn't it? Yeah, 5 years.
5 years, yeah. We kind of got in a room and went, what happened? I think there was a tension in the group between some members who wanted to go out and tour all the time and some members who didn't, wanted to be in the studio and write stuff. And I felt like we were touring just to keep the coffers up at Factory, and touring was taking a toll on my health. I actually ended up in a hospital in Chicago. I think it was probably because I was drinking too much. I had lots of tiny cuts, abrasions on my stomach, and I think it was drinking too much and too many late nights, you know. And that was a bit of a clarion call for me, you know. It just made me think about the sort of lifestyle I was leading, you know. I didn't want to end up like another Jimi Hendrix, you know, or one of these guys that just burns out from overdoing it. And I didn't want to do it, so, you know, I wanted to chill out the touring, and that met with opposition. I was still getting a bit of opposition from using synthesizers as well. So,
even after that time?
Even after that time, yeah. I thought, well, I'll just do the synth stuff out of the band, you know. And then if we can come to some accommodation over the touring, fine, you know. But it created a bad feeling, I think. It created a bad feeling that I was going to do some stuff out of the band. And it created a bad feeling that I wouldn't go on tour every time they want me to, for the amount that they wanted me to. It wasn't everyone. But plus that, there was enormous business and financial strains on the group. I felt that every record we made that was a hit and maybe made a lot of money was just liquidated in the great Factory Records cash liquidation machine, you know, and it either went into the Hacienda or it went into the record label. You know, and I got pissed off with that. You know, I thought, well, why am I doing it if you're just wasting all the money? And not just me got pissed off with that, all the rest of the band, Stephen and Peter and Gillian, got pissed off with it. You know, why are we doing it? I remember Gillian saying, why don't we go on strike? Just go on strike. Next time they want to do an album, we'll just go on strike. So it kind of exploded because of all those reasons I've just given you.
It does give you an opportunity to work with some fantastic people. You work with Chemical Brothers, you work obviously with The Electronic, with Johnny Marr, you work with Carl Bartos from
Neil
Kraftwerk.
Neil,
you know, I mean,
Chris.
This is some fantastic people. I mean, how do these collaborations come together quite naturally, or do you think Kraftwerk always loved that band? He's on the hit list. Chemical Brothers, they're awesome, always on the hit list.
Yeah,
how does it happen?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, with Electronic, the idea was that it would basically be a core of me and Johnny. And then each album that we did, we'd get a different collaborator in, you know. So on the first one, it was Neil and Chris from the Pet Shop Boys. Second one, it was Carl Bartos. But then we got the, oh, they're a super group. Crap, you know, and we just didn't like that, really. So we made the third one on our own, really. So, yeah, but, yeah, getting to work with your heroes.
Do you regret kind of starting your order up again? Because there seemed to be all manner of wrangles. Although the first kind of movement of the band, Reunited, seemed to be quite good. And then it seemed to descend into arguments again.
Yeah, I know.
Do you regret starting
it? I don't regret starting it up again, no. Okay. No, because we did some really good gigs. And I think we made two really great albums. So it was worth it for that alone. And you're right, at first everything was all right. But things went tits up again. rather more seriously this time.
You first announced Bad Lieutenant in June 2009, when people first heard about it. How important is it to you that people see it as a full band, not just a Bernard Sumner project?
Well, it's not just a Bernard Sumner project, and I think they do see it as a full band, because I keep getting asked by journalists, you know, why haven't you done a solo project? Why don't you ever... Have you ever thought... No, they don't say, why haven't you done a solo project? They say, why have you never done just a solo project? And the answer... I'll answer that question. The reason is, it's not as much fun, you know. I like... A band is a social thing, and in a way, Bad Lieutenant is kind of my therapy for the disintegration of New Order, you know. So it's been my therapy and it's held me together, really. Not that I would have fallen apart. I've handled worse things at sea, you know. And we just get on, you know, we just get on really well. But, you know, this we're only talking about, you know, a year and a half together. It's not 2 years together. You know, let's see if we still like each other in 30 years. I bet we don't.
We've had all these first points on these different pivotal moments in your life. So we'll finish the show with the final track. What should we play? It could be anything from your life or anything that you think was important to you.
Temptation. Because that's a track that people, New Order fans, really, really love. And I love playing it, even after all these years. It's the one track I never get bored of playing. And there's something really special. And something about that track. I don't know what it is. If I knew what it was, I'd write another one like it. But I don't know what it is. So it's both intriguing and it's just a great vibe.
The bosses at Six Music have given me 45 seconds to promote my show and tell you why you should listen to me, Sean Keaveney, from 1 till 4pm in the afternoons. That's 10 seconds gone. You see, this trail isn't about the bells and whistles and whatever else you might normally expect to hear on a radio trail, you know. Panned voices, sound effects, exciting whooshing sounds. None of that. And actually, we're at the cutting edge of broadcast technology because it's available on the BBC Sounds app. You can get me on your phone and listen wherever you like. But just beware, sometimes you'll think your Wi-Fi's cut out. When in fact, it'll be me not pressing a button in time. That'll do, won't it? Thanks. See ya.
Six Music.
Sean Keaveney.
Monday to Friday. From 1 till 4pm.
You had to.
This is BBC Radio
6 Music. 6 Music.
Right now, it's Chris Hawkins.